Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So hey everybody, welcome to episode 324 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitchell and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And we're also joined by Mark Rubin in San Jose, California.
Hello.
Alrighty. But I don't have any fact check from last week and we don't have any Ask MTJC, right?
I didn't see any Ask MTJC and fact checking. Yeah. We just got everything 100%, nailed it all, I'm sure. Send your hugs to the folks at Slack and GitHub because they had kind of a rough couple of weeks between the two of them.
Why is that?
I have no idea. I'm sure there's post-mortem stuff, but just like internet stuff is happening. I'm sure it's a whole bunch of folks, you know, streaming Super Bowls and online schooling and work and all that other stuff where we're straining at the edges of network connectivity. And it's been probably the better part of a week that we've had various cold fronts around the United States and tons of snow in places like the East Coast. And even our area is slated to get some snow. So it's probably more kids and others, you know, staying home and stuff. So
they're having COVID lockdown snow days.
you would think that there should not be a single thing as a snow day anymore, but apparently that's still a thing.
Yeah, but you were thinking it was lots of like Super Bowl streaming and stuff this week.
Oh, CBS All Access went down for a few minutes during the Super Bowl as everybody tried to view it, which is of great irony given that they spent so much money promoting Paramount Plus, which is just a rebranded CBS All Access,
right,
with Paramount stuff added to Viacom CBS's backlog.
CBS Plus went down because, or All Access went down because of the Super Bowl or because of the ads?
I believe since the Super Bowl was on CBS in the United States that people wanted to stream it through, you know, Apple TVs and Rokus and Chromecasts and stuff rather than doing it through, you know, like your normal cable provider or over the air. And, you know, it's rough. It's rough when your network services are not ready for millions upon millions of the stampeding, rumbling herd coming to you.
Right. I just remember that old Cisco commercial where, I think I probably told you guys this story, where a guy's selling ice cream out of an ice cream truck and he's in the middle of Italian piazza where there's like, you know, like lots of room around him. And he looks up and as he's serving the kid the ice cream and there's like a thundering mass of kids running towards his little ice cream truck wanting ice cream. That's the vision I have of that kind of, you know, not ready for the demand kind of thing.
Distributed computing is hard, folks. If you're in school, study that sort of thing, because guess what? Every year we're like, oh no, there was troubles buying the iPhones. Like, of course there were. Millions of people trying, both legitimate and bots, trying to all acquire these devices. And distributed computing is hard.
Doesn't seem to be happening as much now that you mentioned that, because the last time we bought iPhones. Was there a big thundering stampede towards them? Like, nobody could line up at the Apple Store, for one thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, the phasing of the availability of devices, I think, kind of helped. So we're like 2 or 3 weeks apart, right, between the Pros and the 12, the normal 12s, and then
the Max
and Mini came out as sort of a later one. So,
well, do you think they do the staggering because of the demand, or they do the staggering because it takes that much longer to get the parts?
I figured it was manufacturing, you know, hiccups related to COVID that happened, you know, early in the year, but it had the nice side effect of splitting up the amount of rumbling herd that comes begging for iPhones, you know.
But so, it feels like the rumbling herd has kind of not rumbled as much since we started buying phones online, don't you think? In the early days, you had to, they were so hard to get. You had to call around to all the different stores and check out these websites that would tell you which store had it in stock, and they never did. And when they did, you had to rush down there and get it, or you had to camp out, you know, the night before they're supposed to be released and all that. But ever since they've been available to order online, it feels to me like just the internet is perfectly capable of handling that because they're ready for it, and just everyone just sort of orders it and they stagger the delivery times. So the, you know, the lining up and the big like hype about have to get there first to get the phone first kind of is gone, don't you think?
Yeah,
I could see that as things have matured and as there's more available capacity and just easier options. And I would be very curious how much engineering goes into like the Apple Store app, where, you know, they've really highly encouraged people like, oh, go, you know, reselect your options. And then when we flip the switch to let you in, all you have to do is just go check out. I'm like, well, you've downloaded all the assets, or they're pre-baked into some version of the app or something. And so they reduced network traffic and other contingents. So now you're really, really only worrying about, can we synchronously, you know, decrement the amount of you know, stock that we have and charge your credit card and et cetera. Where I'd love to know one day what sort of thought and processing has gone, or processes have, you know, they learned from over the years, since it's been, you know, more than a decade worth of them having to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, I mean, the best part now too is when you order, there's no guessing about when you're going to get it. Like Mark was saying, in the early days, you had to run down and hope you got there in time that they had stock. Now you know you're getting it in 2 weeks, right? You were getting it in 3 weeks or whatever.
And it seems to me, they've done this last couple of things I've ordered. They are being very conservative. Maybe this is due to the pandemic, but they're very conservative on the date they quote you. And the last two times, the thing has arrived like a week before the date they originally quoted. That happened with the iPhone 12 and this M1 I just got. They quoted a certain date on the website, and then I checked back, and then all of a sudden, oh, it's shipped. And it arrived literally a week before they said it was going to arrive.
Oh, that's good.
That's nice.
Good news.
Yep.
Some good news for you folks.
Yep.
All righty. So we'll just jump in with some follow-up items, and we've got quite a few since we've been away for a couple of weeks. But and so if you were living under a rock, maybe you have, maybe you haven't, but apparently there was some sort of exploit in iOS 14, and I don't know about 13, but there was an announcement last week that we should all be upgrading to, or I guess it's the end of January, all should be upgrading to iOS 14.4. I don't know if you guys have done that, or you were heard of this at all, or anything about it?
Well, I did the update. Hadn't really heard too many details about the vulnerabilities, actually. So I guess I have been under a rock. Was this the one that... Oh, I think I did. We might have talked about this before. This is the one where someone found a way to... I don't remember. Tell us about it.
Was it like AirDrop or something? like AirDrop or ad hoc Wi-Fi networks or something, where they could wirelessly just take control of the device? And we said it was like a movie where you just sort of look at the device and it's hacked, sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. A remote attacker might be able to cause arbitrary code execution. Apple is aware, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it's funny. I just finished watching Homeland. I don't know if you guys have watched Homeland, you know, the show about the girl that's in the CIA. Anyway, just watched the final season, season 8. And like right up until the last show, she, you know, she's about to turn herself into the FBI or whatever. And she was walking along the street and she takes her phone, she takes her SIM card out of her phone and snaps it in half. Are we still snapping SIM cards in half in fiction, as if that's a way of tracking where you are? Anyway, so then she throws the phone into the garbage. But I just thought it was funny that people still think SIM cards somehow, or at least writers of science fiction or fiction protection. I think SIM cards are have lots of personal information on them or something. You guys have no comment.
I mean, it makes it easier, right? You can correlate those things, whereas, okay, take the SIM card out and destroy it, so it's harder to see, like, oh, look, it was going on, you know, the 1230 train to go to this person's house.
Yeah, but right? Like, surely the IMEI number is where they track things, right?
I think they also we're also not considering whether that was like a SIM that got purchased specifically for the committing of crimes sort of thing. like a burner phone was like, well,
yeah,
let me buy a burner iPhone or Android, whatever it was they were using.
Yeah, where do you buy burner SIMs? I never did figure that out. Yeah,
you need to buy buy SIMs.
The burner SIM store. I mean, is it so crazy though? Because if the call is being tracked just by, if it's a completely anonymized phone, let's say an anonymized SIM card, then the calls that you make are being tracked by some number that's on the SIM card, not in the physical phone, because that's how the network identifies you. And then they have this record of calls somewhere that were made, and if they find that SIM card on your person and that has the ID that was used to make those calls, then they've tracked those calls. They've correlated those calls to you as a person.
Yeah,
right?
I don't know. I think the infrastructure is way more sophisticated than what SIM card you have in your phone, you know? Because, I mean, like I said, the IMEI number is how they actually track the physical device. And, you know, and the radio has a MAC address and all that kind of stuff. And then you're using some sort of payment vehicle to buy time on this phone. I don't know, just Spycraft just, you know, eludes me.
Yeah.
Anyway, speaking of which, there's a show called Spycraft on Netflix. Just to follow up here, we're on the M1 computers. There's mm-hmm. new startup modes. And my friend Zvon has another article here on his at your server website talking about the different kind of modes to start up. Like, I've been, you know, working on Macs for forever, it seems like. And, you know, I know all the key commands, you know, to get them to boot into recovery mode or to target mode or what have you. And the M1 has changed all that in terms of how things are loaded. And I think the key is you hold down the power key in some ways and you get this new startup manager thing that comes up. So, Mark, now that you have a M1, you may want to just have a glance at this article so you know how to get in and out.
This is good to know. Yeah, it's interesting. I do wonder where he got this information from, because mm-hmm. there was no manual that came with it that said there were all these new things. And I haven't been looking for this information, but I haven't seen this information anywhere before. So this is actually really good to know.
Well, like me, he's a Mac IT guy. And for years, he's taught in Canada anyway, he's taught the course on, you know, Mac server admin that the Apple certified courses, one of the instructors. So he probably put this together himself. These look like screenshots that have been made like with a camera or something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's good. I mean, yep. like I said, the different ways to get in and out. It's pretty much all the same routine to get into the startup manager, it's called, or whatever, and different ones. So if you want to reinstall your Big Sur or open up Safari and browse around and all the sort of, you know, run disk utility, you know, set up your password for your firmware password, that kind of stuff, all that can be done through this interface, which normally is done by either holding on the old Macs, you would hold on the option key to choose a startup drive, or you would hold down Command R to go into recovery mode, Command T to go into target mode, Command C would boot from a CD drive or a DVD. I remember when we used to be able to boot from CDs and DVDs. But
yeah, I remember when you used to be able to boot from floppies.
Yeah, I remember that too. In fact, I have a computer that runs off floppies, as a matter of fact, now you mention it.
Yep.
Anyway,
but no more PRAM. That's, I don't know if I'm happy or sad about that. I guess I'm probably happy about that, because it always kind of sucked that you had to zap the PRAM every once in a while.
Well, the SMC still is. Lately, the SMC has been more troubling than the PRAM.
Well, there's no SMC either, according to this article. Very last line of this article.
Oh, no longer seem to be able to wrap.
No longer exactly, seems right. to be available.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's like I think the closer we've talked about, you know, how the Mac OS is moving towards iOS in terms of its, you know, features and stuff. Like, I think people are probably thinking more like desktop kind of stuff, but it seems like more under the hood, they're moving more towards, they're converging in terms of how the hardware is set up, right? Because they don't really have these modes on iPads and iOS as well either. They have some, but not as sophisticated as this. Alrighty. But now that we're on the subject, I just wanted to get Mark, you received your M1 a couple of days ago.
I did.
You want to give us the rundown on what your experience is so far?
Yeah. So I got the, I think I talked about this earlier about what my plan was, but I got the M1 mini. And the reason I chose that one, well, my old laptop, which I've talked about many times, was a 2013 model that served me well, but was getting to the point where I was kind of eyeing it, wondering if I was going to get up one day and in the morning and have it, you know, not wake up, you know, so I figured it was time to get something new. But yeah, I wasn't thrilled about the laptop offerings with the M1. And, you know, we know that there's going to be better ones next year. So I figured I'd get a mini, which will tide me over until a year or whenever, when the new MacBooks come out. So I did that. I got the mini. I got the 16 gig version with a terabyte. And it took, like I said earlier, they quoted about a month delivery time, but it actually showed up in just under 3 weeks, which was a real nice surprise. That was great. Really easy to set up. It actually has more ports, it seems like, than the 15-inch MacBook Pro that I use. That may not actually be true, but there's USB-A ports, which is actually kind of nice because I can hook up my monitor through the USB-A port. Because I have a display, what is it called? The display connector that I convert to USB-A that I use for that. So it took, you know, I did the restore from Time Machine, and it took all night, but next morning it was good to go, running Big Sur. And it, you know, it's pretty great. I mean, it's, I haven't had any issues yet. I did have to do, when the first time I ran it, I had to do some Rosetta. I had to install Rosetta and things like that. I guess it wasn't installed by default, but it just did it automatically the first time I tried to run an app that needed it. And it's, compared to my 2013, it's pretty snappy. It's pretty fast. So I'm pretty happy about that. I haven't run into really any issues yet at all. So
are you finding that when you open Safari, for instance, it's like a single bounce and then it's open, or?
I haven't really noticed, but let me try. I mean, I certainly haven't noticed it as slow.
Yeah, no, I find that
single bounce and it's open. Yep.
Yeah. Same thing with Xcode and things like that too. I was going to ask too. So there was no, was there any facility for you to do like a disk to disk transfer? Like, I guess lack of ports, right? Was your, like, you couldn't put your old Mac into target mode and then hook it up like a, and just do a migration off of it, right?
Oh, I didn't even try that because I actually did some research on that and looked up what is the preferred mode, and right. They actually say it is preferred to restore from a Time Machine backup rather than
from a disk
using
or from
the migration
a network drive. We want a disk.
I connected a physical Time Machine disk.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Rather than trying to go through it would have been horrendously slow through a network. I mean, it already was slow, but would have been even ridiculously slow through a network. I could have used Migration Assistant, but I chose not to. So it worked pretty well. I do have all my old 32-bit applications still in my applications folder, and obviously they don't run, those didn't get, well, I mean, that's kind of my fault. They've just been sitting there for a while now, and I'll have to just delete those manually.
Were they running under Catalina anyway? Like, they weren't, right?
No, I didn't have Catalina on that machine because I had some 32-bit applications. That was exactly why.
Right.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. I'm surprised that it actually installed them, thinking, you know.
I kind of thought it was going to just remove them too, but you know, I could see people being pretty pissed off if it just removed them without telling you. Yeah, you could see people getting pretty unhappy about that. So they probably chose not to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I did have some kind of funny things that I had to do for some development work that I was doing, but you know, this is all like command line Unix level type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Some things like, for example, Golang. Right. If you install that from Homebrew, first of all, you can't install Homebrew directly.
I thought Homebrew just came out 3.0.
I happened to open an old shell with some kind of special command that they gave me on the Homebrew website, and then I could install. And I'd have to look up exactly what that was, but it was.
But
just
do you remember that post that Jaime talked about on the last show where you could have two terminals? You make a copy and set one to use Rosetta and the other one to use.
Yeah, that's what it was, right?
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's what it was. Yeah. But once I did that, then Golang, the existing version on Homebrew doesn't run on the M1. So there is a beta version, but you have to go and install that directly from, you can pull down a DMG from their website and install that. So there's just a couple of little things like that, that, you know, those aren't things that your average user is going to be doing. So I can't really fault Apple for that. It's, you know, I'm installing third party software. So it's Google's fault that Golang doesn't work on the M1, not Apple's fault.
Right. Well, since we're on the subject of M1s, and my experience too, is that, and we were just going to talk about it before the show, and that's the DTK has been, we've been getting notices from Apple saying they're time to send them back. They haven't given us the instructions on what to do yet. So I dug my box out, but, and we were talking, I think the original offer was $200 US, which is nothing to shake. You get quite a few Tim Horton coffees with that. You know, not that you could use it for that, but, and there was a restriction about when you could use it, but I think there was a lot of complaints from people on socials and online and stuff like that. And Apple has increased the credit to $500, which, if I'm not mistaken, was what we paid for it in the first place. And then we get to use that as a credit towards the purchase of a new M1.
Yeah, I was actually about to ask you that. It $500 that you paid?
I'm pretty sure it was, because it might have been $550 or something, but it ended up being $700-something Canadian for me, right? Mm-hmm. Plus GST, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, so that's half, like you said, halfway to buying a new M1, whichever way you go, right? Mm-hmm. So, and to be honest with you, like, and I made this point on our Slack in that, and I've said this to a few people who've listened, that, you know, when I went ahead and decided to get the DTK, I knew that I was just paying Apple to let me use the machine and work on my apps, you know, to make them compatible with the M1s or whatever, or the silicon, I should say. And I wasn't really expecting to get anything back for that, you know? And I heard that, you know, James Thompson talked about on Twitter about how when he was on the 486, you know, when they originally did the switch over to Intel, there was a beta program for people, and they did the same thing. And they got, like, you know, they didn't get, like, the money back. They got something, but they didn't get a full refund kind of thing. And I kind of went into it knowing that. And my other point is that if you're a company that is making money on Mac software or, you know, iOS software, and you're profitable, right? Like, maybe you're in that $1 million club that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. I'm sure $500 to spend on a DTK is not a lot of money, right? So, it kind of, you know, I'm glad Apple decided to go ahead and change the policy, which is great for me, you know, but I was happy with the $200 they were going to give me, right?
I mean, I think you're looking at it in a very healthy way. I do think, well, there's two different things going on here, right? So I very quickly want to address that. I think given the size of Apple, it absolutely would have made sense to just, you know, make the developers happy, because it costs you very little given your size to do so. That's a little bit separate than strictly from, like, a business transaction standpoint. What did they owe you? And it's like, well, they kind of owed you nothing. I think you paid, let's say, $500 to participate in this program, and you have to return the device afterwards. So it's kind of like, hey, I have paid $500 for, hypothetically, my business to be ready, right, for, yep, software launch on the first day. So there's a symbiotic thing, right, where it's very clearly in Apple's benefit to have people update their software and have it ready day one. So that's kind of where I'm like, you know, Apple, just, you should have just done people a solid instead of penny pinching on and going back and looking really bad and cheap from it. But from a you know, for you as an individual, not you specifically, but for people listening as individual developers, is like, did you kind of just want to, you know, tinker around with it, and you weren't really a serious business, and now you're like, oh my gosh, I thought I was gonna basically play with this toy for free, and now I'm only gonna get $300 of it back, subsequently $500, so you're made whole. I'm like, I think that's kind of where some more of the anger is coming from, that people didn't realize what they were buying into. And I think,
yeah, but if you read the terms,
it was the serious developers,
there was really no promise made by Apple to say you're gonna get back your full or anything, really. It was just sort of, you get to use it for a while, and then you're gonna have to send it back. That was what the agreement was.
Oh yeah, totally. Which I think, you know, if you've got a business that does, like, you know, some serious money from your apps, it's like, dude, yeah, absolutely, I would easily spend 10 times more to make make sure that my business is ready for continuity, right? Like you'll spend more than that on just insurance for your business, right? And that's where I think there's probably a little bit of a disconnect where some folks either felt entitled for reasons that didn't make a whole lot of sense, given that you weren't strictly speaking entitled in a very literal sense to anything other than you give us 500, we give you a device for a limited amount of time, we take the device back. And I also
you signed a contract, right? I mean, you lease a car and you pay the lease every month, and then you give the car back at the end. You don't expect to get
and you don't own the back, car,
right?
Yeah,
yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. But I think there were just probably too many folks who thought, oh yeah, well that's what they said, but this is what they did back in like the 90s or early 2000s. Like, well, I mean, it's probably completely different people managing the program now. Are you sure they will have the same sort of thoughts? And I also do highly suspect there are a number of folks who just wanted to play with the shiny and didn't really need the DTK, right? Mm-hmm. So I calculated out this math and I was like, all right, what would it have really cost Apple? Like, I have no numbers. I know nothing here. But I'm like, let's say they had 10,000 of these devices go out. And that seems like a lot. 10,000 of these devices. So it effectively costs Apple like $3 million extra dollars for the giving you
notwithstanding a full also 300 the R&D on the device too, right?
Sorry?
They also had to do R&D on the device. They also had to design it, engineer it, you know, get it manufactured. I'm sure it cost them something to do this, right?
Oh, sure. But that's like, you know, capital investment for like, you know, trying to make sure that there's continuity of their third-party developer ecosystem. I'm talking about like, you know, why did Apple, somebody somewhere at Apple very clearly made the decision, whether they made it explicitly or carelessly, or they just thought like, hey, you know, I've got a really good idea to get myself a bonus. Somebody said, okay, so we charged them $500. If we give them $200, but a very limited time, it's like they have to use it by May. And guess what? There are absolutely no new M1 devices coming out by May, let me tell you. It's like somebody said, aha, so not only will we have reclaimed in most cases, you know, at least, you know, $300 that we've gotten to get away with, the appearance of the $200 isn't real because it's like one of those rebates that nobody ever expects you to actually, you know, turn in and follow all the proper procedures. Like, you know, that $200, I'm like, dude, okay, just accept the fact. If it was $200 you were willing to give back as credit, what does it cost you extra? I was like, well, for $300 extra across 10,000 devices, that'd be $3 million or like roughly the amount of money that Apple probably spends on literal apples at like Apple's campus, right? Like its yearly budget for apples, the fruit, is probably $3 million or less. So it's like this is the smallest of rounding errors. And I have to believe that somebody was either being very, very foolish or was incentivized to like, hey, Lopez, find a way to make a little bit more money for this department. It's like, hey, I've got this idea, and yeah, then didn't float it past the right people who would have probably stepped in and said, hey, don't be, you know, don't be chintzy on this. Don't be Scrooge McDuck. Like just make them whole.
Well, it could also been that charging something for this privilege, you know, as I'm calling it, charging something for this privilege also vetted out the people who don't really need to do this. Right. I mean, and you know, if they had made it $1 like they did for the Apple TV, they would have sold out in a second. Right. The fact that you had to have this $500 bar, right, meant that you had to be willing to part with $500 to use this device for whatever 6 months or 8 months or whatever it's been, right? You know,
yeah, that pricing floor definitely helps weed out some of the folks who weren't, you know, sort of serious about, you know, because Apple's not doing it out of charity. It's not like, hey, you get to play with this toy. It's intended to be, please make your software better. It's good for you, so you can continue to sell software, and better for Apple, so that it has this wide variety of software that's available for the M1.
It's actually pretty standard practice to have a development kit that you charge for. You know, if you have a hardware product, for sure. You know, if you are selling a chip, let's say, and you want users to develop a system around that chip, well, you sell a hardware kit that they can plug the chip into and use to build their thing around. That's really standard practice. What isn't standard, as far as I know, is having to give it back at the end. That's the unusual thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that said, I mean, I don't think anybody's mentioned this, but I think in the letter they sent us, it tells us that the device will no longer update anymore. Like whatever beta of software we have on it now is where it's going to stop. Like the software updates won't run on it, which is crafty too, right? But I think that, you know, necessary in this case, right?
Yeah. What would they have done if you just didn't return it? What will they do?
I don't know.
Probably what the deal nothing, is there. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's again, another thing. Reason why they charge $500. I'm sure they're going to lose a number of these to the people who want to keep them and put them on eBay in 10 years, right? Or whatever, right?
Yeah. I don't think the vast majority are worried about the cost of the hardware that they're losing, though.
Right. Well, speaking of weird new hardware, too. So I have an iPhone 12 Pro, as you guys know. And so I was getting my Mac fixed at one of the stores, and I inquired about a MagSafe adapter. Anyway, so I ended up getting one for my iPhone 12 Pro. And I was concerned about, I use a third-party case on the back of it. And so there's like, you know, there's like, I don't know, half a millimeter of distance between the back of the phone and this. And surprisingly, the MagSafe does work through the other plastic. I think that if you look at the cases that they have, that Apple sells, they have like a little, I'm assuming it's some sort of magnetic ring that fits on the case, and so that it makes a better thing. Like take a naked phone and connect it to the MagSafe, it glues right on, right? It's a bit slippery, and it does tend to come off on this third-party case, but I think it's because the magnet is held a first distance away from the actual phone. But it's cool when you plug it in. It does the sort of like little circle thing that the watch does when you plug the watch into the charger. You get that little graphic with the lightning bolt on it and the green ring. But yeah, and it's pretty quick. It definitely charges much faster than a key charger, so yeah. Money well spent. You do have to plug it into a proper USB C port with 20 watts of power, I believe, right? So you can run it off a USB Mac, or you can run it off the iPad charger.
I have one too, and I use it without a case at all. And it's on there pretty tightly. In fact, I worry a little bit that it's a little too tight, that it's going to scratch it or something trying to pull it off.
Oh, really? Yeah.
But it hasn't seemed to have had any issues.
Well, it's interesting too with those wallet sort of card holders that you can get for the back of the phones. And yep. I would worry that those fall off, but apparently the magnets are really strong, like you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's cool. All right. Enough about that. So I guess we'll speak of hardware, back to Jaime.
Yeah, I wanted to talk briefly about the, I'll just read the title here from this Ars Technica article that we'll have linked in the show notes for those of you driving at home. So, sorry, small phone lovers, the iPhone 12 mini was Apple's 2020 sales flop, which is juicy as far as headlines go. But when I look at the chart, and again, this is an audio only medium, so recommend you pull over or something and check the show notes. So I think it is true in some respects that the launch of the 12 mini in the same year that the SE, which is also a smaller and cheaper phone, maybe wasn't the best mix, right? But combined in terms of small phone usage, I'm like, well, you know, if we say this is 5% according to this Counterpoint research, and visually I think the SE is a little bit more than 5, we're talking 11-12% of their sales would have been small phone devices like the iPhone SE, the iPhone 12 mini. I'm like, well, I think I personally wouldn't have launched the mini and the SE in the same year, but as far as, you know, small phones go, I'm like 12-ish% is probably not too bad. I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to remove that from the list of iPhones that I was selling, you know, trying to find a phone that fits everybody. I do think it is also true that if you are a small phone lover, you are very clearly in the minority, right? Like the facts and data speak for themselves in that two times, you know, into the well, and you weren't able to overcome any one of the 12, 12 Pro or 12 Pro Max, the most expensive phone in terms of sales. So you can gripe about it all you want. And I'm not saying you're wrong. Like, whatever fits your needs. I prefer Pepsi and most people prefer Coke. you know, I'm not going to say you're wrong, but just realize that, like, when you're like, oh, they should make us another, you know, small phone, it's like, well, I mean, you gotta convince people to vote with their wallets then, because clearly people are not agreeing with you.
So are we talking $699 for an iPhone 12 mini? Is that right? US dollars?
I want to say that is pretty close to correct. So it's pricier than the iPhone SE.
Can you buy the SE? Let me see what the SE is costing.
Caveats with, you know, COVID and pandemic and economic uncertainty and et cetera. But I don't think we've ever seen, other than pent up demand, I don't think we've ever seen the SE or other small devices just like blow things out of the water. And given that the 12 Pro Max, the like very, very expensive device, easily outmatches both the SE and the 12 mini combined. It's like, well, I mean, can you really fault Apple for making larger and more expensive devices if people keep buying them?
Well, I mean, there's a whole Face ID argument too, right? But the home button thing, but the SE, which looks very much like a 6, right, I guess, in terms of its style, it's $399. So that's like $200 less than the mini, right? So I think that the mini kind of caters, it's kind of like when the year we had all those too many iPads, remember that? And you never knew which iPad was the right one to buy.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to have an inexpensive iPhone, then the SE makes a lot of sense, right? You know, because then it's you're basically a $400 investment as opposed to $700 investment for a mini or 12 mini, right? So it's I guess if you want the better features but the smaller form factor, the mini makes sense, right? But yeah, it's hard to say. It's the whole medium popcorn argument, right? Like I think the iPad the 12 mini loses in that it's only a few $100 more to go to a proper 12, right? Or 12, yeah, because it compares to the 12, not the 12 Pro, right? Yeah.
No. Well, the mini has 5G, right? And the SE does not.
Right. But like I said, if you don't want to spend a lot of money on a phone and you want to get an iPhone, then the SE makes sense, right?
Right. Right. No. Yeah. So where I was going with that is that that's presumably the reason for having both models available at the same time, the SE and the 12 mini, because in theory, well, whether this is reality or not, but in theory, there might be people in the 5G coverage area who need the fast speed but like the small form factor.
Mm-hmm.
So my guess would be that by this time next year, the SE will cease to exist and the 12 mini will take the position of the main small phone because there won't be any 4G version. That's my guess.
So this next story is I've been working on a little bit of a side project. Carol's wanted me to write an app for her for a couple of years now and I've been procrastinating. But yeah, and I'm a fan of Core Data, and so we talked about Core Data and Swift UI a few months ago. And so I decided to dive in. I was actually more interested in CloudKit because I do have actually an app on the store that where you can export and import information, but I never really got around to doing CloudKit on it. And so I was looking at whether I can, you know, put CloudKit support into my Core Data app. And it is surprisingly simple to switch from the old iCloud sharing or whatever it's called to CloudKit. CloudKit is like, it's like one click in the app setup when you go into the capabilities. You turn on background processing for notifications, and it's pretty straightforward. So with Core Data, you know, you've got the persistence layer there, and you basically write, Core Data is really simple now with the new persistent container is it called, or persistent store?
Persistent container, yeah. It's so much easier. I mean, that's been around for a few years now.
Yeah.
But it really, really changed everything with Core Data.
Yeah, it's way easier to use. And with Swift UI, it's super simple. And then with CloudKit, like I said, it's almost like one click to set it up and do a test on a couple of devices. The simulator is not quite great at iCloud syncing, but I ran it on my iPad and my iPhone, and it was like pretty simple. So I've got a couple of links here for people who want to go down that route. One I found yesterday from blackbirds.com is a tutorial, very clear tutorial on building a Core Data app with Swift UI. It's interesting because he doesn't go you start off with the Core Data template, but he gets rid of the stuff and then brings it back in one step at a time to sort of, so you get a better sense of how they're using the environment variable to make your manage object context, and then as well how you refer to things within the app when you're working with the data. And then the second one is from raywunderlich.com, and it's like last year I think was when they wrote this one, and this one is about using Core Data with CloudKit. So both of them cover Swift UI, and they both take a different approach to it. But they're very simple tutorials. You can do them in like an hour, and you'll have a good understanding how to do this stuff. So kind of cool. So I'm, you know, happily building my app and syncing in the cloud, as it were, right?
Tim, not only am I happy that you were getting that working, is this technically follow-up to an Ask MTJC? Didn't somebody ask us a while ago of like, hey, I've seen tutorials
guy?
With persistent store before, and I've seen CloudKit stuff, and I haven't seen something that combines the two. I think we didn't have an answer at the time.
Guy? Yeah, it might have been Jolt Guy asked us that one.
Yeah, so here you go. your continued patronage is eventually rewarded.
Yes. He's actually one of our patrons too, so even more.
Perfect.
More literal than I was intending.
Yeah. Anyway, and I put this one next one up here, but Jaime originally posted it in our Slack channel, I think, right? And that's the and good news for Canada, yay Canada! Apple Card and Apple Cash trademarks have been approved in Canada, which means that you know that's the first step in getting the trade name registered, and then it shouldn't be too long before some form of Apple Card will come available to Canadians, so we'll be able to buy our Tim Hortons, Timbits, and our Mac hardware with the Apple Card, and hopefully get the same deals that our U.S. patrons have been getting for what you've had the Apple Card for a couple of years now, right?
Yeah, at least a couple of years. Yeah,
yeah. And I Apple Cash, I guess,
it will be
too.
2 years in for me, like August, and I think July is when people were able to get them if you join the early wait list or something.
So this other one is a real quick hit for those of you out there who are fans of the show and fans of Spotcast, and maybe users or maybe you have an Amazon Prime account, but Amazon Music a couple of months ago started adding podcasts to the mix, and so officially they launched it last week. So now you can enjoy More Than Just Code. I've got a link here to the Amazon Music page. You can listen to More Than Just Code, or you can listen to Spotcast on Amazon Music, as well as Google Play and Spotify, and of course, the usual suspects, usual podcatchers like Overcast, Apple Podcasts, Pocket. I think what's the one that Greg uses? Pocket?
Pocketcast,
like
I think.
Pocketcast.
Is that the one that was owned by NPR and that they were spinning back out?
I have no idea. And then Castro and all those kind of guys as well. Cool.
Real time follow up. I just checked my finance software, and the first balance for my Apple Card was on August 23rd, 2019.
Oh.
So not even 2 years, year and a half.
Yeah. Well, it normally takes a while for them to ink deals between different countries too, right? So, yeah. And then they have to find someone to carry the financing and whatever. All right. Because I don't think we have Goldman Sachs in Canada. Right? Anywho, this is a new one. So, Mark, you have an Apple Watch?
I do have an Apple Watch.
And Jaime, you have an Apple Watch?
I do.
And I have an Apple Watch. You can now unlock, well, soon, I shouldn't say now, but soon you'll be able to unlock your iPhone while you're wearing a face mask, if you have an Apple Watch. Because in 14.5, they've added the ability to unlock your phone by authenticating through your watch. Ta-da! Nice.
Yeah, this is another thing we're going to throw on the mountain of MTJC bump things, where this is pretty much as we described, like, hey, if I can unlock my MacBook with my watch, why can't I unlock my phone with my watch, given that you can sort of tell it's probably me, you can tell that there's a mask, why not, do me a solid? Right. And, I'm sure those fine engineers at Apple listen, they're like, oh, that's a good idea, MTJC, thank you, we'll take that one.
So do you think under the hood, do you think that they're actually still using the facial recognition to recognize your eyes anyway, and then using like a second factor authentication with the watch?
Yeah, so I think, there's some snarky people like, oh, finally, why did it take so long? It's like, well, think about this. Normally, the phone unlocks the watch, right? So now you have this bi-directional thing. How do you accommodate that? You have to be very careful. And you have to be extra careful because you don't want to, oh no, we've made this too permissive and now everybody and their brother and sister can unlock your Face ID protected device, right? Like you still want security. And this presumably took some time to figure out all the different scenarios, what would be the use cases, aggressive, security testing, and probably training of the models of like, okay, how can we be sure that, with varying kinds of masks, not everybody wears the same kind of mask. Not like it's standardized in any, realistic ways. Some people are using bandanas and some people have, plastic ones and some people have, homemade ones and some are using the more standardized ones that you might buy, but colors and texture and how does it fit on your face? Like there's a lot that goes into, how do we train a model? So like, okay, there's a reasonable chance that it's this user. We have detected that there is a mask. Now check to see if the watch is within range and the watch is valid and et cetera. Like I'm sure it's non-trivial. Obviously, I would have loved to have had this right at the beginning of the pandemic. I'm not going to complain given the security concerns that go into that. I want it to be, still secure, but yes, convenient in 14.5.
And they probably had the solution, the technical solution 6 months ago, and it took this long long to get it through the lawyers.
Right.
To be honest.
Yeah.
That's true. It's true. Yeah. Cause I mean, to be honest with you, Carol was complaining to me a couple of weeks ago that she has to use her phone to unlock her watch, you know, or just enter when she first puts it on. Cause she doesn't always grab her phone and her watch at the same time. And she was sort of saying, why do I have to enter my passcode into my watch? And I explained to her that the two work together. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to iOS 14.5 because this will help make things more convenient when I'm out and about. And I mean, it's still kind of rare, and I don't want to sort of dilly dally anywhere that I do happen to go. It's largely, you know, transactional and get out, but it's still sometimes I don't want to have to put in my passcode or do other things. And for 14.5 for me, I will finally be able to use the Xbox Series X controller that does not have compatibility
right,
until 14.5. I'm like, yay, I'm kind of looking forward to getting Apple Arcade and playing some of the, you know, games that kind of need a controller.
For me, I see this as a nice thing, but the truth is the thing I use my phone for most these days when I'm out and about, granted, I'm not out and about that often. So the thing I use it most for is Apple Pay. And if I can wear my watch, I can just use the watch for Apple Pay. So I don't actually need to use the phone.
Right.
So I see it as a nice to have, not a world changer at this point, but it is nice to have.
Yeah.
I can tell you, I'm walking my dog every day, and we have a daily hangout we do in the morning before we start work. We have a coffee call, and we all get together and just chew the fat about different things. And I'm often walking my dog, and since it's like minus 10 here, Mark, I have gloves on, mitts on actually, and I have my hat, my toque on, and I have my glasses, which go black because I'm outside in the sun, and then I have a face mask on. So you know, I regularly, if I have to do anything on my phone, I have to, you know, take off a glove and, risk frostbite to, you know, unlock the phone or hit the mute button.
I will point out before people are too impressed here in the States that you are talking about minus 10 Celsius, not minus 10 Fahrenheit.
Oh, right. But well, minus 10 Fahrenheit is what?
Pretty cold.
Yeah, minus 10 Celsius is pretty cold too. It's below zero.
Right? You go Fahrenheit to Celsius? That's negative 23 Celsius if it's negative 10 Fahrenheit.
Oh, really?
Or was it the other way? I might have misheard.
I don't know. It's math. Yeah. All right, let's move on to our what's new in Swift there, Jaime?
Well, wait a minute. Hold on. So 0 degrees Celsius is 32 degrees Fahrenheit, right?
Yeah.
So minus 10 is minus 10 Celsius below zero Fahrenheit?
I don't know. Let me get Pocket Calc out and ask Pocket Calc.
Hey, Siri, what is minus 10 Celsius in Fahrenheit?
14.
14 degrees Fahrenheit, which is cold, but not as cold as minus 10 Fahrenheit.
Okay, fair enough. It's still pretty cold. I'm still wearing, like, no pants and proper Columbia jacket and my Thinsulate Canada, you know, with the Canada logo on them, gloves and that kind of stuff. Yeah, from the Hudson's Bay Company. Alrighty. Now can we move on to what's
new?
Let's
move on, please.
Very, very briefly, because I think some of this stuff is easier to see, trying out the playgrounds.
Should people pull over first or what?
You really should. I would not advise trying to check this in the show notes while you're driving. So Hacking with Swift, which is done by Mr. Paul Hudson at Two Straws on Twitter, has done a, you know, what's new. And there's some stuff that I thought was nice. Well, to varying degrees, some things are like, yeah, that's super nice. Like the multiple variadic parameters is pretty nice, where sometimes you don't always know precisely how many players do I have, precisely how many integers. And I don't want to make four slots or two slots. Just however many there are, send them in. And it's not necessarily something you can easily just turn into an array, as an example. People were wondering,
And presumably it removes the constraint that you can only have, what is the number, 10 views in Swift UI without using a group?
Oh, I wonder about that. This doesn't talk about that implication, but I am curious if you're right there.
Because that was the reason for that. They had to, because they didn't have multiple variadics like this, they had to have explicit signatures for all the different types of view closures for each number of views. So if you look at the implication, there's one with one view, there's two views, three views, four views, and they had to choose a number to stop at so they weren't writing these signatures all day long. Right. And they chose, I think it was 10. I could be wrong on the number.
Mm, yeah,
but now that they have these, they don't need that anymore.
That's good insight. That probably is a good driver for doing this.
Yeah.
There's other smaller quality of life things of like, you know, it's not hugely impactful, but it's like, yeah, this is an obvious thing I like, where like having the improved implicit member syntax with the option here of like, hey, you could change the foreground color to like dot red. It's implicit what you're doing there. It's shorthand is how I think of it. But, oh, did you want to change the opacity? Well, sorry, compiler's not smart enough to figure that out. So color dot red is what you're going to use. I'm like, oh, well, now I can do just dot red dot opacity. You know,
nice.
Cut out all the cruft. Big section of this blog post is talking about result builders, which are formally went through the Swift evolution process. So they'll work as you expect. I'm going to spend a whole lot of time there. Having the packages can now, in Swift Package Manager, can now declare executable targets, which is pretty nice. If you wanted to use like at main and not do the thing like, well, it doesn't want to work because it's hard coded to look for main.swift. And a couple other things like the property wrappers or local variables. And the example it gives is like a property wrapper ensures that its value never goes below zero. So clamping is something that seems like it's a whole lot easier.
Kind of cute. Yeah, that's kind of nice.
Yeah. Sometimes it's useful of like, all right, you know, user tries to decrement. All right, well, I want to make it so it's not possible to go, you know, below a number and presumably above a number if you wanted to clamp the quality of life stuff.
Mm-hmm. And how could iOS 7 apps save you 500 megs of storage?
It's funny that you read it that way because I also read it that way. No joke. And I was like, why is this in my newsfeed? That is so old. I was like, oh, it's not iOS 7 apps. It is how 7 of such iOS apps could save you 500 megabytes of storage. And I bring this up not as a, oh, like, gosh, just go shake our fists at these various apps, but more, oh, yeah, it might be an opportunity for folks to take a look at their own apps and say, I wonder if we're doing something like this. So he's run some sort of analysis here. This is Noah Martin. And some things end up bloating up the size of your installed application, like Dropbox, for example, could hypothetically reduce a lot of its duplicate localization files. I mean, how easy is that to just like let it get duplicated over and over in your setups, right? It's like, oh, we need localization in this new watch target. It's like, all right, whatever, man, just copy the file over and call it good, right? Like it solves your immediate need, but has implications depending on, you know, how much stuff you've got in there. There's font files for this Spark app. What did eBay do? eBay included unnecessary Swift symbols because like some framework somewhere was supposed to use a method to strip non-external symbols. There's like a whole bunch of interesting sort of things here that I'm like, yeah, you know, if you're a team of one, I kind of doubt that you would have these serious issues. I think these things start to happen when you have, you know, tons of folks all trying to ship and get things done. And it's pretty easy to lose sight of like, hey, wait a minute, like what's going here? How big is this thing getting?
So there's no solution. It's just he's pointing at 7 apps that are culprits of using extra space, right?
Well, the solutions here are like, don't include these extraneous font files.
But you're talking to Dropbox. You're not saying the end user, right?
No, it's a little bit of a clickbaity title.
Yeah, yeah, he's basically saying, if these 7 companies cleaned up their apps, you as a user who has these 7 apps on your phone would save 500 megabytes of storage. That's what the headline means. But really, the story is about how you as a developer can do this in your own app.
Right. Okay, good. No.
Like, okay, here's one way down at the bottom. Lyft. The Lyft app has hundreds of duplicate files, the largest of which is a single asset catalog copied 73 times in separate bundles. I'm sure there's really good reasons why that is, right? And I'm really looking for like, you know, A-B tests and et cetera. It was probably easier to like not have to have like a common team deal with it. But it's also a little silly in the aggregate to have the same asset catalog 73 times in separate bundles.
Right.
You know?
All right. And then he said,
this one, I always wanted to get the pulse of the panel here. So the title is The Diminishing Utility of MF Mail Compose View Controller. It's a very short article. It talks about like, hey, prior to iOS 14, the one and true only email app on iOS was the mail app. It comes pre-installed with the device.
Right.
You can do other apps, sure, but really you could never know what was going to be going on. So for developers, you'd say, hey, if this mail compose view controller can send mail, or sorry, send mail, go ahead and compose it, set your parameters and delegates and move on with life. And that's cool. And that's great. And it will absolutely continue to work in iOS 14. But what this developer, and I'll try to catch their name, is proposing is like, well, in the new world, Stuart Breckenridge, is it looks like your name. What they're proposing is like, well, maybe to be better and more respectful of the user's choices in terms of email apps, whatever they're using, don't use Mail Compose View Controller. Instead, add the Mail To scheme to the schemes that you handle and use the UI application shared can open URL. And if you can, go ahead and open that URL. And that'll trigger iOS to say, oh, which of you is the default mail app? Is it you, Gmail? Is it you, Outlook? Cool. Here you go. User wanted open mail. And it has a feature request for iOS 15 where default mail app should have some equivalent of MF Mail Compose.
Yeah, I was going to say, because like, don't we have to pass, if you want to fill out, because I do know, I do use the MF Mail Compose View Controller in a few apps where we pre-populate some of the mail, right? So the user just has to hit mail and then, or hit send, and it runs through the mail app. But I guess we have to figure out how to pass those properties over to whatever the choice of email client the person is using, I guess, right?
Yeah, and given what Apple has done with other things, if I was an Apple engineer designing this, I say, Lopez, we need you to come up with a way to do it. Developers are screaming. It's like, all right, well, you know, we have an intense INTENTS system for a whole bunch of other things like Siri Kit, for example. Wouldn't it make sense to have a intent that says the user intends to compose some mail and the correct default app gets access to that? It gets fired up. It's like, hey, here you go, Gmail, or here you go, Outlook. Here's the intent, which would have very similar things like you'd need to have a defined subject and recipients and maybe some way to pass information back so that, you know, what do you do when you're done with your activity? Maybe you might want to send the user back to whatever app they came from. That's probably how I would implement it. So if we see it in iOS 15, MTJC bump, we're going to be reclaiming it now.
It seems to me there might be a way to do it. There's close to a way to doing it already today. I can't say 100% that it exists. If the assumption, I think, has to be that the third-party mail tool has to obviously be installed on your phone, right? So if it is, why can't that third-party mail app just write some kind of an extension? And so it pops up. So there's a mail extension, right, that pops up in your share sheet right next to the Apple Mail. Mm-hmm. And there's the Gmail extension. And you just choose that one instead.
Right. That's possible. So you would see it like bringing up a sharing sheet kind of thing versus having, like, this is the default app I use. I wanted to just bypass the sharing sheet selection. Like, maybe it would show it the first time, but have, like, a checkbox or something like, used as the default way to open these?
Well, I mean, it's a different use model for the user. Right now, you know, your user will tap a button or something and it'll pop up the share sheet and you populate the share sheet. Or equivalently, you can package up all the information and open an activity view controller and have them maybe choose message or maybe choose whatever or choose mail. And then it gets populated in the mail if they choose that route. Both of those are possible right now. So in order to allow a third-party mail tool to do it, there'd have to be some kind of hook where your third-party app would show up in the share sheet, just like, or the activity controller sheet, right? Instead of, or in addition to the Apple Mail one. But that seems like it's close to existing right now. But there may not be an extension point for mail. I don't know. It's been a while since I've looked at that stuff.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm unsure.
Yeah, yeah.
But something interesting that I thought very short here to think about, of like, oh yeah, we just sort of take for granted that Mail Compose View Controller exists, but maybe it should be replaced by something a little bit more modern, given that the operating system has evolved over the last decade.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, I do have a couple of apps that use it, and I'm just trying them right now, and it seems to work okay. But then I'm still using the default Mail Composer, right? Oh, wait, one link's not working. Oh no, people can't email me. I guess I have to do an update. Alrighty. I tried one app, and sure enough, the Composer did open, but the second one seems to be broken. Anywho, so I guess we'll move on to our picks portion of the show. Should I go first, Tommy?
Sure.
Yeah. So I was on the Swift UI bandwagon this weekend, and I just happened to notice this as I was working away on my little Swift UI app. I sometimes had, in one example, I was using a floating button above my view, where basically I was using a Z stack, I guess to call it, where you have, like, you can have overlapping elements. And so the button was sort of floating around the bottom of my form, and when the keyboard opened up, it kind of obscured obscured the button. So there's a really interesting article here on Swift UI keyboard avoidance, which is something we've all been wrestling with in our entire iOS careers. And so in some really interesting examples here, he's got like in his text here, he's got like a small little view with a couple of boxes, one's red, one's yellow, and then he calls up the keyboard when you tap on a form element. And in some cases, the views shrink to make room for the keyboard, or sometimes they don't. And so he's got a couple of examples here on how you can change the size of your views or not to basically allow the keyboard to have enough room and not obscure or obscure your view elements. There's a ignore safe edges you can opt out of if you don't want to have it play nicely or not, right? So just a couple of quick legal examples here. Some with some code you can play around with to try and see how they behave in different circumstances. Cool. You guys have watched the little videos? And
yeah, it is nice. And it's not as if there weren't solutions out there, and they point out that you either, you know, took the snippet off of Stack Overflow or you pulled in a CocoaPod or something. But it's kind of nice to just have the default behavior or just do what you would expect it to do.
Right.
You know, and yes, I'm sure there's folks that might have very specific needs, but it always felt for a very long time of, you know, this is a really common use case, and having some default handling that's, you know, pretty sensible is reduces the sort of barrier to entry, right? It lowers the floor of, look, man, I just want to get to the next part of the app that's actually fun, not the keyboard avoidance part that I'm going to spend the next 8 hours fighting with.
Yeah. Well, and there was for one app I was working on, we had a number of fields in the view. And of course, you had to animate based on which field you were on. And then once you left that field, you had to animate back to put your view back to the way it was. And then, of course, an Apple started coming up with different size phones. And yeah, just it's been fun. And then, of course, you have iPad versus iPhone. And what do you do in one case and not the other? And
The easiest way was always to use auto layout and just have the bottom view constrained to the bottom of the
safe area,
the safe area with a variable constraint. And then just in that observer, that when the keyboard opens, just grab the height of the keyboard and set that size constraint to the size of the keyboard. Boom. Automagical.
Yeah, that's what I started doing in later years. But I think up until that point, it was up until auto layout got sensible, because auto layout went through its sort of pains as well, right?
Yeah.
So I was doing a lot of frame animations and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The next one, I was going to talk about Swift UI Jam, but I just found out that they're closing the registration midnight tomorrow, which basically means that by the time the show comes out, it's too late. So if you didn't listen to last week's show and get signed up for the Swift UI Jam, course, it's in Toronto, but it's virtual, so it doesn't matter where you come from. But if you were lucky enough to find out about that, you can join us on the weekend of the 19th. I think it's a couple of days event, starts on Friday, ends on Sunday. Yet another iOS Dev Happy Hour is coming up on February 20th, which is the same weekend. We're meeting at 4 p.m. EST, Eastern Standard Time. And I can tell you, I went to the last event. Don't be fooled by the name Happy Hour. The majority of people were drinking water. The way it worked is we had basically a large room with, you know, pages and pages of people on the Zoom call. I think we had 370 at one point. On the main stage, if you want to call it that, they had a couple of people do some quick talks, you know, talking about their career as iOS developers and that kind of stuff, and some, you know, human interest kind of angles. And then we broke off into breakout rooms, and where you met, you know, you hung out with 4 to 5 other developers and talked about, you know, COVID and how they're dealing with things and where they work and what part of the world they're from. I mean, I was hanging out with people in California and some people in Europe and that kind of stuff in some of the breakout rooms. And there were some names there. If you're looking to meet up with some names, there were some people who were there that if you follow on the Twitter, she might, you know, be interested to meet or say hello to and that kind of stuff. So it's kind of interesting little thing, but that's coming up on the 20th of February. And and you can get your ticket through Eventbrite, and there'll be a link in the show notes, and I'll be there, and I'll see you then. Over to you, Jaime.
Yeah, mine is something that I found. I don't remember who was the original source. I'm sorry. Maybe I saw it on Twitter or something, but it's called GitHub 1S, or possibly 1 second is the way it's intended to be read, given that the tagline in the readme says GitHub. 1 second to read GitHub with Visual Studio Code. It's kind of neat. So what I understand this to be doing under the covers is actually another thing about it, something I'll talk about later, because first I should tell you why you should care. Well, if you were ever like, I wonder what this code that I'm looking at on the interwebs on GitHub would look like if I had like a real IDE around it, right? Because sometimes, you know, even as nice as GitHub has made its whole UI, and it does some syntax highlighting, it's not quite the same as seeing, you know, this drill down view that doesn't exactly replicate mentally what these folders are going to look like, and et cetera, et cetera. So this here is a nice little trick where anything where you would have had, like, you know, their example is github.com/Microsoft/VS Code. That's the repository for Visual Studio Code. You just change that to github1s.com and then the rest of the path, and you get this nice web-based Visual Studio Code view of that. So for folks that are curious to see it in action, I threw a link in the show notes here that is the Vapor project. So similar. What would be github.com/vapor/vapor is github1s.com/vapor/vapor. And if you fire that up, you're like, oh, here's Visual Studio Code running in a web version. And I can click through and see future.swift and see everything sort of as the way nature intended the syntax highlighting to work. I can see the exact sort of file system or directory layout for this project. I don't know that something like Swift would run in here, but let's see why it couldn't, given that Visual Studio Code is not only a pretty popular text editor and, you know, nascent IDE. What I think this is probably using under the covers is Microsoft has done a whole lot of work to make something I think called Code Spaces or something similar. They changed product names like a dozen times, so I apologize if I have the wrong name. But they're really trying to integrate VS Code into the GitHub experience, where if you're like, I see a bug here, it's like, well, rather than cloning the repo or changing to a branch, it's like, hey, what if I just was able to do all of that through the browser, through the editor? And rather than trying to edit with a sort of meager text editor, it's like, what if you just use something as powerful as VS Code in the cloud, in your browser, to do this? And that part's speculation because it's not explicitly listed in what's going on there, but I can read the tea leaves and say, hey, I think I know what's going on here.
That's right. Microsoft bought GitHub, didn't they?
They did. And yeah, there was like VS Code Spaces, or maybe it was GitHub Code Spaces, and a similar-ish product that was like VS Code in the cloud or something. And I think that's what this individual, ConWNet is the username, or NetCon, I guess, is maybe what the user is supposed to be read as when I click on their profile. It's just neat. Like, if you ever, I haven't tried doing any development type work with this, but being able to see the layout like you would see it in an actual IDE is really nice. It's a lot easier than just trying to click through these different folders that are broken down a little differently for the way that GitHub's traditional UI shows things.
Okie doke. Right. Well, I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you, where will they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @devofthehair.
And Mark, if people want to get in touch with you?
MarkR@mapsoft.com.
Right. And as usual, my name is Tim Mitra, TimMitra. On the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. So until next time, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fireside.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends, leave a comment on the website, or write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC, and we may mention you on the show. Friends of the show can also join us on the podcast Slack channel. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is @MTJC_podcast.
Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/mtjc. Every dollar pledged helps a lot. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.